welcome John C. from Los Gatos.
My name is John, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, John.
I am absolutely delighted to be here. I'd like to thank Gene for inviting me. I like alcohol. Thank Alcoholics Anonymous for allowing me to come, and Jack for bringing me. I just love Alcoholics Anonymous because this is whenever you're in a bind, and I had a hell of a good time here this afternoon and this evening because I got worried about I was supposed to speak somewhere and didn't know where it was, and I knew you really knew who I was and didn't want me to come anyway. And typical to the great polish and veneer that I have acquired since I got sober, I picked up the telephone and dialed Alcoholics Anonymous, and the answering service came up. And with just all the class in the world, I said, "I gotta talk to somebody." Alcoholics Anonymous, as my rides were telling me that. It appears as if I needed my pride leveled a little bit. Now, fortunately, I have found that Alcoholics Anonymous can and will do for me what I cannot do for myself. And it has been doing it for me since the day I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to tell the newcomers and those who introduced themselves and those who didn't, they're going to treat you nice for a little while. Sometimes they get just absolutely vicious. You know, I walked into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous not because I knew anything about the disease, not because I knew I had a problem, not for any reason that I had any knowledge of whatsoever, other than a friend of mine, or a man who insisted that he was my friend. Because I didn't have any of those. I kept going to my wife and I said, "What does this sucker want? You know, he keeps hanging around. He wants to go out and drink and together." I understood that. But I couldn't understand what it was that he wanted. Well, this guy couldn't hold his booze very well, and he had to go to jail. And after going out of jail, he and I had gotten drunk that night. He went immediately to Alcoholics Anonymous. In magic. And my time had come, and I didn't even know that. Because 7 days later, this kid persuaded me to walk into my first meeting. I don't know why. I went, perhaps just to get him off of my back. I don't know what it is. At that time, I had no conception of what had happened. But I will tell you that it was the greatest single moment of my entire life. The greatest single moment of my entire life, and that's awesome to me. The love of Alcoholics Anonymous is as intense as it is that it could take someone like me who knew not where he belonged, had really been looking for you but didn't know I was. And for such a long time, I had been looking for you. I didn't know where you were. They could reach out and touch me and bring me to you. And from that moment to this, the quality of my life has gotten better. Everything about me is, almost everything about me has gotten better. If you question that, you better ask my wife after the meeting. You're celebrating anniversaries this evening. I have a significant day tomorrow. It's significant to me because someone at a meeting while I was sober for a while, somebody announced that it was their day, and I've been waiting for this day for a long time, and I have little significant anniversaries. Today or tonight, I happen to be sober 4,999 days, and 5,000 seems like such a beautiful number for me. And I will be 5,000 days sober tomorrow. That's awesome. Just absolutely awesome. sneak that in. I got a lucky applause. It might be the only one I get, but that's all right. For those of you who do not, I could save you the arithmetic. That is exactly 8 days, 8 months, and 13 years ago. And the quality of my life has gotten better from that day to this. It's just amazing to me. But you see, as one of the demonstrations that I have, and I did not know this when I walked into my first meeting. I didn't walk in and say, "Wow, God, I've been looking for you." But, oh, no, I didn't. You know, the first miserable SOB I met insulted me. They were not nice to me in my meeting. They're nice up here, but not down there. They were not nice. I walked up to the first guy. My friend brought me to his meeting. If I had been in my own car, I would have left and died. But I was with him, and I got to play it cool at any time. And I walked up, and he introduced me to this slob, and the guy looked at me, and he shows you the great polish that I had. Is that this guy said, "Oh, you've got a problem with alcohol." And I said, "Doesn't everybody?" Son of a bitch said, "No." And you said the weirdest thing in that meeting. Gadget, you talked about stuff that was disgustingly personal, and then you'd laugh. You just shouldn't have said some of those things. God, I wouldn't even say those things in my own bedroom. And here you are talking at the podium, and you're doing stuff like that. And then my second resentment, that was the second person I met. Turned out to be... He's the one that said I didn't have enough guts to stay around this outfit for 90 days, and I figure I'll show you. Naturally, he's my sponsor today. I always did have poor selection in people. But I walked to my first meeting, and this is a story. This is how it happened for me, really. Because I walked into that meeting at St. Luke's, which is in Los Gatos. And I was angry, and you said crazy stuff, and some of it interested me. But I didn't like you. I had a miserable time. At least I thought I had. My friend called me the following Friday, and he said, "You want to go to another meeting?" And I said, "Jesus, are there different people there?" And he said, "Yes." And I said, "I'll go." And so I went there, and, you were a little better, but... You know, not as miserable as slobs were in Los Gatos. And my friend called me the following Tuesday, and he said, "You want to go to another meeting?" And I said, "At that place?" And he said, "Yes." And I said, "Well, maybe they had a bad day." And I went back there. And you had changed, and you had gotten so much nicer. And God, nobody insulted me. And my friend called me on the next Friday, and he said, "You want to go to a meeting?" And I said, "Gee, I'm sure looking forward to it." And I went to that meeting, and I fell in love. And I called my friend on the next night, the Saturday night, and asked him, "Bob, do you want to go to a meeting?" He was busy, and I had to come alone. And God, I was afraid. I had to go to a place that I'd never gone. And I've been doing this for a little while, and I came aware with one of the great truths that I have found in sobriety, and I told you it. This is the greatest single moment of my entire life. It occurred when I walked into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I thought it sucked. It does not give me a great deal of knowledge as to how... I do not know what's best for me. It was a huge awareness. I don't know what's best for me. When you stop to realize that the greatest single moment of my entire life occurred. And I missed it. And it had a formation, it created a desire within me to try and do what you talk about is this one day at a time. Because another man said right around that time, he said to me, and this had a huge impact on my life. He said, "I had a great day yesterday. God, it was a good day. But I didn't know it until today." That was me. That was the story of my life. But I honestly do believe that I came to you because there was no other place for me to go. Not that I knew this, but I say that my time had come. You know, my time had come long before I got here. It just was inevitable that I reached the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's not because of my talent. It is not because of that. And it was because my time had come. I share that because I was talking to my daughter, and I had been a few months sober, and I have a large family. We have 8 children. I was a periodic, you see. And oversex Protestant. I was talking to our oldest daughter, and she lived in Nebraska when I got sober. She had run, cowered, and she was in Nebraska, and I was telling her about this beautiful thing called Alcoholics Anonymous and that which I had found. And she said, "Daddy, can I tell you something? And good God, you know, I've always wanted my kids to talk to me, but they were afraid." And so my girl said, "Daddy, can I talk to you? Can I tell you something?" And I said, "Certainly, dear. Please tell me anything you want to know. Anything." And she said, "Well, Dad, a couple months ago, we started a Bible study class." And I said, with all my newfound spirituality, "Well, good, everybody needs to get close to God." I said, "Yeah, but Daddy," she said, "we decided in this Bible study class that we were going to find some poor soul and pray for them." And you see, I love the fellowship. You had somebody praying for you too, because that's what she said. She said, "Daddy, we picked you. My time had come. I did not know it. Christ, prayer works long distance, and I did not know that." This has been the only good life I have ever known, and the only really easy life that has ever been mine. When you consider the things that I had to do in order to do what I had to do to get here, it mind-boggles me. Just absolutely mind-boggles me. But you see, when I got here, I didn't know. And I always have to tell that specifically when we got newcomers in here. I didn't know. You know, one of the great deceptions that we suffer from, the great problem that the alcoholic suffers from, is called self-deception. You know, denial, if you would, but I call it self-deception. I didn't know. I did not know I was an alcoholic until I got here. I did not know many things about my life. I knew virtually nothing about the truth of my life until I got here and had been here a while. And they started talking these horror stories and war stories, and Jesus, I didn't do that. If I had done that as bad as you, I think I'd have come to Alcoholics Anonymous too. Those are the things that I was telling to myself. And I was immediately disqualifying myself, and immediately, although I wanted what you had to offer so desperately, I did not have a drunk love. I did not know that I had a drunk love. It was concealed from me. I had an awful lot of bad breaks. Oh, God, I had bad breaks. I didn't start drinking until a retarded age of 18. Okay, and now in society, that's a latecomer. But I gave a lot of attention to it, and I drank consistently for 30 years, give or take a day. I started sometime in the middle of March of 1946 and quit sometime in the middle of March 1976. And that's a long time. I started in, there'd be an unusual aspect about the way I started drinking is the fact that I started the way most many people have to quit. I started in Skid Row. I liked it there. I liked to be on the knife edge of stuff. I was in Washington, D.C. I loved to fight. I had a great talent for fighting. I was so interested in fighting that I had to give up the ring to go to the streets because I wanted to fight. I loved it there. I learned there what many people have never learned. And sometimes it makes somebody a little, but sometimes people get a little upset because they say it, but this is nevertheless what I learned there, and I did not know these things. Everything I offer to you is the stuff I've got since I've gotten sober. But I learned there that's where you had to save your first vomit in the morning. This might be the only drink you're going to get. Okay. That's where I started. Many people in there, I don't know. All I know is that I had to do what I had to do. I fell in love with bourbon whiskey, and I've always wanted class. And so it took me 10 years to learn how to put ice in it. And it took me another 10 years to put a splash of soda in it, because that really was the epitome of class as far as I was concerned. And so I wound up my drinking, if you would, at the Branham Lounge with a Jack Daniels over and a splash of soda, or a splash of soda, because I had 10 years of supposedly comfortable drinking, but it was never good for me. You see, a long time ago, something happened in my life, and you know, everybody talks about this illusion of escaping and having fun and the good times with the drinking. Now, that is possibly very true for me, but I don't remember all of those so-called good times. I didn't have my share of good times. I had good times for maybe a couple of years. But you see, I've had huge things that have interfered with my drinking. A large family. I was married to my high school sweetheart, and she had to die. And part of it is perhaps because of my alcoholism. I don't know. But I do not know, because there's no way of getting it, but I do know this, that I was a shitty husband, and I didn't want to be. And I was a miserable father, and oh God, I tried hard to be a good one. You know, in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, amazing things happen. Really amazing things happen. And I told you that I walked into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the quality of my life had gotten better from the first date. The first thing I started to do when I got here is I wanted what you had. Oh, God, I wanted what you had. I tried in my own ways to dig out a little bit on the side. But you see, there's some steps standing between me and what you had. And one of the first things that they pointed out to me in the big book, and if you haven't heard it, I would certainly point it out to you. It said, because I have always been one of those guys who has said that if you tell me how to do it, then I will or won't. But damn it, there is no hope for me unless I know how to do it. And they said the clear cut, precisely how we have required. And I understood that. And then they pointed out a line in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that stated that if you want what we have and are ready to go to any lengths, willing to go to any lengths to get it, then you're ready to take steps. Well, I had to find out what the hell you were talking about. I understood I wanted what you had, but I did not know. I had no conception of what any lengths meant. What do you mean by what it is that you're talking about when you say any lengths? Because you see, no longer could I say what I've said so many times. Yeah, I want it. Yep, right on. I'll pay. I'll do all these things. But they said, no, you can't do it that way. You have to make some conscious decisions. And you said, so if you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps, and not one damn minute before. At least that's the way they told me. And so I had to figure out what was any lengths. You know, one of the first things they had to tell me, and I had to read in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, to choose between an alcoholic death and a spiritual way of life is not an easy alternative. But I had to choose. And I found that was a very harsh thing to say to somebody like me, that you either choose a spiritual way of life or an alcoholic death. When you have done the things that I have done and have come from where I have come from, don't tell me I'm going to choose between a spiritual way of life or an alcoholic death. And you told me I had no alternative. And so I had to recognize and concede to this fact, and this fact solely at the very beginning of this thing, this magnificent journey called sobriety. That it was going to be a spiritual way of life, or it was not. And if it be a spiritual way of life, then I could have all those things that you offered. And if it was not a spiritual way of life, I could have an alcoholic death. That was not an easy alternative. But you made me, because I wanted what you had. Nobody forced me. These are conscious decisions that I made. Now I'm sitting there and I'm reading this book over and over and over and over again because I want what you have. God, I do not understand what is required of me. And you say that, oh, well, you have a choice here. It's in the chapter to the agnostic, and it is that God is everything or He is nothing. He either is or He isn't. And what's my choice? And you didn't offer me any You didn't even ask me whether I believed in God, because if you had, I'd have told you no, because I didn't believe in God. I didn't want to believe in God, and you were asking me to make a huge decision that God's everything or He's nothing. He either is or He isn't. But you see, you took the edge off of that, because you, back in Bill's story, you reminded me and told me one more time that I got to choose my own conception of God. Choose it. What a challenge that was. And I got to thinking about that, choosing my own conception of God. Because first of all, if there be a God, I didn't want any part of it. And then you cornered me behind that, because in Bill's story, he says, to Christ he conceded the certainty of a great man, not too closely followed by those who claimed him. And I hated the religious people. I knew full well that they were wrong, and all the problems of the world were created by those fools who were in the religion. And I figured that if a guy could write a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous who thought the way I thought, there was hope for me. Because elsewhere it says, do you now believe, or are you even willing to believe? And these are things that I had to look at and make decisions of. And I chose, and I started looking at this business of a God and my own conception of it. And I'm being a father, and I say 8 times over, I am a father. And I started to think about it, because you offer a prayer in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and all meetings. And one of the prayers that I've heard in all meetings is the Lord's Prayer. And you start with Our Father. And here I am praying something I don't even know what it is. And so I had to think about it a little bit. And being a father that I am, and having 8 children, I started thinking about it. What kind of a father would I like to be? What kind of a father have I tried to be so hard? How hard I have worked to be a good father and failed. And one of the first things I had to concern myself with is that I loved my children, and I'm the one who raised my children to believe that I loved them because I had to. Not because I wanted to. Not because I did. I raised my children to believe it. I loved them because I had to. Because I thought that was the only way. And you told me to choose my own conception, choose my own God. And so I decided that God was love and it was unconditional, because that's what I wanted to be like. And then I got to thinking about my kids, and I'm saying that, well, is there anything in the world that they could do that would cause me to stop loving them? And I couldn't think of a soul. Not one thing that they could do. I sure as hell would disapprove of many of the things that they did, and I did disapprove. And then I got to think about that, and then I realized that I was going to, if my kids were going to go in the wrong direction, then I would be offering them difficulties. I would stand in the way of them doing improper acts, if I could. And I started to get a conception of God as I understand God. I started to get a feeling of this thing, and I started to understand much, much more, readily understand those things that you were asking me to do. And because of that, it seemed as if things started working well, and my life was working well, and I didn't understand what was really happening about this, and I'm caught up in the euphoria and the excitement of the beauty of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm going to meetings, and everything is amazing to me, and I'm all excited about the glory of life, and I'm talking about this, and I'm talking about that, and I go home, and I since my first meeting, I have made the mistake of sharing everything with my Al-Anon, and that's a very serious thing to do, because one of the things I told her, I said, honey, you can tell me anything you want, and she did. My wife is here, and if she stays nice, and next July we will celebrate 30 years of bliss with a little time out for bad behavior. But one of the things when I talk about my wife and the likes, that I have to interject something about, you know, many of us believe, and I was one. Totally convinced that when I got here, I can't do anything right. It's all my fault. I can't get it right. And everybody I touch, I hurt. I'll never get it right. But one of the early things that I found out, it was because of my recovery and my involvement in recovery and the magnificent things that were happening, that she decided that she wanted to go into Al-Anon because she wanted a piece of the cake, because it was too good to pass up. It was beautiful. And it was only because of one of the requirements, and I go back to once again, the conditions by which you state that I must fulfill in order to go to any lengths to get recovery. And I had to learn how to share. And I figured that I would share with an amateur, not a professional. I didn't talk to you for 3 months, but I sure as hell talked to my wife because she didn't know when I was screwing up. But you did. And I'm not going to show you nothing until I'm ready to show you. One of the things that I was totally aware of is when she got involved in Al-Anon. Al-Anon will never be the same. That I truly recognized that this woman I had saved. Saved. And this is the good act that I did before I got here. Is because she was born in Al-Anon. She was absolutely from the cradle in Al-Anon. She had the misfortune of waiting a few years until she found her alcoholic so we could fulfill her. Everything she ever wanted in a man, I am. She needed a drunk desperately, and I gave her one. If you have trouble following what I'm saying, then it's on you. So do I have trouble following what I say. I get things that are of interest to me, I start talking about. And I never know exactly what's going to happen here. Hopefully it will be enjoyable. One of the things that is a constant amazement to me is the fact that more is constantly being revealed to me. You know, I was going through the book and the excitement that was happening to me and the beauty of my life. And I walked up to my wife one night and I said to her, I said, Peggy, I'm scared. I said, everything in the house is going well. And I'm changing. And I don't know what's going to happen. This is such a ride. This is so beautiful. And I'm changing. And I don't know what's going to happen, but I can't stop it. And I'm not going to. And she looked up to me and she said, well, don't worry. You're turning into exactly the man I've always known you were. What a beautiful statement that is. You see, I was about 2.5 years sober, totally engrossed in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, as I am today. Once I started, all hell broke loose in my life. I was in a meeting and I was about 2.5 years sober, and I came with a profound awareness, just an awesome awareness. That in this meeting, I became aware of the fact that I was everything I ever wanted to be. Everything I had ever wanted to be. I was a good person. I was a gentle man. I was a good father and a good husband. I wanted nothing else out of life. But I was incapable of having it before I got here. You know, I come in here in this magnificent wedding, this magnificent lady that I'm married to, and the marriage that we have today was right on its, you know, virtually its terminal stages. At best, I call it an endurance contest. And it changed when we got sober. It's only because of you. And it's because, as I said, that everything that has any real value to me has been given to me as the result of coming to you. And I have shared all those things, and I would share them with anyone. I remember when I was, once again, a month or two or three sober, I don't know what happened, is that I was perhaps as negative an individual that can be. If there was a bad way, I knew it. And I knew that I've had nothing but bad breaks all of my life. And I knew that there was this monstrous plot of people that was designed to nail me. You know, when the car broke down, I knew it was in the assembly plant. They decided that John Carney is going to get this car in 62, and that'll collapse, and it's going to be on him, and we can all laugh. I knew that was it. They're out to get you. Everybody's out to get you. I knew that's the way it was. And I was married to this foolish Pollyanna-type twerp who just was under the conception that she had never met an unhappy man until, or a bad person until she met me. You know? And one of the huge things that happened to me almost from the very beginning is the fact that you offered me a living solution to a living problem. Then and now. And I was, this was just going on and my life was working so good and I couldn't understand it, and I'm on this, what people are saying, the pink cloud, beware, beware. Screw you. Because it was good, and it's the first good feeling I'd had, and I was excited about it. And I came home one night, I was coming home from work, and I was relatively new, as I say, a couple months sober, and I walked up to Peggy, and I said, Peggy, I feel strange. And she said, what's the matter? I said, nothing. And she said, what's wrong with that? I said, but I still got this funny feeling. And she said, what kind of a feeling is it? I said, I don't know. She says, well, is the feeling good or bad? And I said, well, God, it's got to be good because it's not bad. I know that one. It's good. She said, well, why don't you just accept it the way it is? And I said, Christ, I don't have any reason to feel good. Because you know that you always have to have a reason to feel good. Everybody has to have a reason to feel good. You don't have to have a reason to feel bad, but you have to have a reason to feel good. And but there's nothing happening. I just feel this god-awful feeling. And she said, well, what would you call it? And I said, God, I don't know, maybe impending good. I have it today. And I don't have to do anything but stay sober to do it. And I don't have to do anything other than what I'm doing. Because it's been mine all this time. This incredible sense of impending good. And sometimes it's just so awesome that I wouldn't know what to do with it. This is so fabulously good and so exciting. You know, and I've had many things that have happened to me in sobriety. Most of the good things, well, almost anything that is exciting to me has come to me in sobriety. In the strangest ways. I remember walking home one night, and I'm saying, Peggy, I got something to tell you. And she said, what? And I said, some people came up to me in a meeting, and because of our fabulous relationship, they came to me and they said, John, will you tell us? The story was that some guy came to the meeting and said that his wife was number two in his life. And because of your fabulous relationship with Peggy, we want you to tell us, where does Peggy rank in your life? And I had to think about that a minute, and I told them. And I had to tell Peggy I had to come home, because as I say, I shared everything with Peggy. And I said, Peggy, I got something to tell you. And she said, what's that? And I said, you're number four in my life. I didn't know what she's going to do. Christ, I had nothing to lose. The whole thing was lost anyway. And everything I had was free time, bonus time. I said, you're number four. And she said, thank God. That's weird. And then she said, this is a hooker. She said, by the way, who's the first three? And it's the story of my life in sobriety, and if you don't have one, I give it to you. He said, I didn't drink one day. And that's the single most important thing in my entire life. As the result of not drinking, I came to you. And that's the second most important thing in my life, because you gave me the program. That's what you represent, the program. And because I came to you, I got the third most important thing in my life, God as I understand God. Okay. And so that's what it is. Because I didn't drink and I came to you and I found this recovery program, because of that and only because of it, and after that, in fourth position, became everything that had any real value to me. The relationship that I prized with my wife and my children and my job. And with you, and with my fellow man, is because of getting my priorities straightened. You see, I have a lot of trouble with first and second, but between there, first and four is a hell of a distance. I was newfound sober, and I was about 4 months sober. And I didn't have the information I had in order to tell you about some of the things to really know in my gut. To really know. I was studying, and I was spending an awesome amount of time studying and going to meetings and listening to the tapes of a man by the name of Chuck C, because I was in love with him. I was truly in love with him. Got to know him fairly well before he died. I was just doing this intense amount of studying, a big book, going to meetings, listening to Chuck. And we were going down to San Diego, and I was 4 months sober, and I could not understand. I knew all the basics. I knew everything I needed to do, and I knew that I was willing to go to any lengths. But I could not understand. I could not get the real handle on what it says in the doctor's opinion about the phenomenon of craving. I didn't get that one down. I couldn't understand, for reasons yet obscure, that the alcoholic has lost the power of choice. It didn't hit in me. Okay. Though we are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking, I never understood. But I had, because you see, I still was offered the self-deception and the delusion that I was just like other people. But you had a way of life that persuaded me to stay here. And I went down to San Diego in a bowling tournament. And as I say, I was 4 months sober. And I went into a place of great, overly confident. My pride was out in front of me, and I was cool. And I got into a place I shouldn't have been. And I should have never been there, and I was so damned overconfident, and suddenly the gates of hell opened up, as far as I'm concerned. We talk about, and you read about it from time to time, about a moment of clarity. I had 2.5 hours of the gates of hell swallowing me, and I screamed to myself that if I live through this without killing anybody or drinking, I have enough information to finish the 12 steps or to do the 12 steps of recovery. You see, I know how to drink. And unfortunately, I know how to kill. That's part of the wreckage. God knows I know how to hurt people. That's also part of the wreckage. You see, there I knew then and for the first time I knew why it was that my wife had turned into such an ice queen. And I knew why it was that my children had run away from me, because they were afraid of me. And I knew why it was, perhaps, that my wife had to die. My first wife had to die. I knew so many things. I knew why it was that a couple kids in the streets of Los Angeles, back when I was one of those kids, when the fun went out of my drinking in a street fight where somebody had to die in that one, that the fun went out and the lights went out, and I spent the rest of my 28 years of drinking trying to bring the lights on and the fun back in, and the insane actions that went behind that. And I realized that the things that you told me in my first meeting came to pass. And you told me that I didn't have to live that way anymore if I didn't want to. You told me that I'd never have to drink again as long as I lived if I didn't want to. And you told me a strange thing. And a strange, strange thing that I offer to you tonight. At least I heard this, and I've never heard anybody since say it, except when they're copying me. And since I make a lot of noise, a lot of people like to copy me just by the sound of it. But in my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I heard the most profound statement that has nothing to do with recovery, and it has everything to do with mine. He said, you'd never have to hurt again as long as you live if you don't want to. And I said, oh my God, is that possible? Is that absolutely possible? Can it possibly be that I can live that way without the agony and the pain of the wreckage of my past? Can I truly have peace of mind that I have never, ever found? Can I shut this thing off? And for some strange reason, that night when on my first meeting I went home, I believed you. And I knew for a cold fact that the wreckage of my past would be done, and I put it aside and said that I will deal with you when I'm ready to deal with you. And that time did come. And it came in the step of in my ninth step. And I finished to put aside the wreckage of my past. I've had so many things that is necessary to do, you know, the awareness, you know. Part of the plot, I have said to you that everybody is out to get you. I believe that. I had a doctor. I hated him. And he hated me. We were so intensely disliking each other. When I finally made my amends to him, he had a needle about that long stuck in my arm. And I looked up to him and I said, you know, I used to think you were the most miserable son of a bitch on the face of this earth. But I was wrong and I'd like to apologize to you. And he said, you're the only fool in the world that would do that with a needle stuck in his arm that long. I had puking down to a science. Well, one of the things I went down to him is I had this incredible series of pains, convulsions, and it just used to double me up in absolute agony. And he says, is there any hope for you? And I said, yeah, every once in a while when I'm in the swimming pool that I had built to keep my kids away from drugs. I'm in the pool, and I seem to relax a little bit and the pain goes away. And he says, well, the next time you get these agonizing pain, then you just fall in the pool. But he said, you probably should ask somebody to watch you. And I remember so vividly on those hot summer days that I'd get up and I'd go into the bathroom and I'd puke up the blood, saving the alcohol, because you can puke around it. Yeah, you can puke around it. Many of you have done it, so I know goddamn well you can, because you can just puke up the blood and it comes staggering out and say, watch me, and you fall into the pool. And then you just stop to realize that there's probably six or seven of them. My kids would stand there and I hope he drowns. And one of them, the Al-Anon, the great Al-Anon, Jackie, she'd say, oh, I'll save you, Daddy, I'll save you. And the ice queen's sitting in the table, oblivious to the whole world. Oh, he's dying? Oh, well. Oh, well. The ice queen, I was involved in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we were in for a couple of years. She was speaking at an Al-Anon function. She's turned into black belt Al-Anon, and she was speaking in this Al-Anon function. And then she said to her, she said, oh, do you know what I used to do to him? Now, I'm always interested in things like that. When people say what you used to do, I just want to find out. Because as most of us, you know, our drunk log is to a huge part hearsay. And when she said, what did I used to do to him? She said, I didn't even realize that till right now. And what she said was that this is the Ice Queen story. She said that, you know, John got awfully puny in those last 4, 5, 6 years before he got sober. And what I used to do, he was all susceptible to bronchitis, and he was very puny and sick. And he'd come home in the winter and he'd pass out on the couch. And I'd go and open up all the doors and windows and turn off the furnace. And he'd go to the hospital. He'd wake up in the morning and he'd be all and say, I've got cold or something. And in the day, he'd go to the doctor and the doctor put him in the hospital with pneumonia. And she said, because, you know, he doesn't drink in the hospital. And I went to the hospital about every, maybe 4 or 5 times a year before I got here. And she's comment with this stuff, you know, and Al-Anon, of course, is willing to kill to keep the sucker from drinking. she says, besides, you know, Who's going to nail me for murder by pneumonia? I didn't know that's why I was so penny. You would be surprised, amazed at the amount of gunk that was in my cupboard that had to be thrown away when I got sober. You know, I could have been an addict. The only reason I say that is that one of the times I went to this doctor who hated me, who was trying to kill me, I went in and I said, God, I'm so mad, I'm going to kill somebody. And I don't know what to do. And he said, here's some Valium. I said, well, I can drink. He said, no. He said, this will take the Valium. And I took some Valium, and I got halfway to work, and I had to pull over to the side of the road, and I was just digging. And I went to sleep. That's what I used to do. And then I went home, and I told Peg, and I said, Christ, if it's going to make you feel like that, Jesus, I'm going to at least have the satisfaction of drinking it. I mean, this is stupid. So I was never an addict because the reaction was too hard, too violent, too hard behind it. It's not out of purity. As I was too busy saving my kids from the ravages of the disease that I couldn't possibly. We got 8 kids. We got 19 grandchildren, 2 on the way, and 3 great-grandchildren. And my kids follow in our footsteps, you know. They all love me today. It is a beautiful thing. I remember frequently how difficult it was to get here. As a man who has had no drunk alone and didn't know why it was that my kids were afraid of me. People have been afraid of me ever since I realized that I could. People have been afraid of me ever since I realized how fast and how easy I could hurt them. I know that my father was a practicing alcoholic. I say that today, not that I knew that then. My dad was a drunk. He died of the disease of alcoholism. I did not know that. He died at the same age that every one of the males. It's an interesting story, but my brother who does not drink, and I are the only male carnies that go back as far as we can go back. And my brother has checked it a long ways because we come from a long line of drunks. He and I are the only two that have lived past the age of 50 because of this damned disease. And my father had to die from this disease, and I didn't know it. I just thought he was a drunk. And I figured he was a coward. And the reason I figure he's a coward is that because like in a good old Irish family, that my dad came from the old school, if you would, that you had to prove your manliness. And when you get to a certain age, he challenged you to fight him. And one of the things that always stuck in my mind is that my 3 older brothers never fought him. And I thought they were so brave. And I thought that took an awful lot of guts. I really was proud of them for not doing that. And when it came my time, I fought him, and he carried the scars to his grave, and I was so ashamed of that. But from that moment to this, or from that moment on, people started becoming afraid of me because I walked around with a knowledge and ability that I could do just dreadful things to people. And unfortunately, I had to. And I didn't know why. I didn't know why the kids were afraid of me until I had this moment of clarity down there, and I could make peace and be at peace with my children. You know, but they're talking about this not understanding and this self-deception that goes in. You know, I was a very successful. I was a street drunk. I was a badass. I married my high school sweetheart. We had one child, and that altered my life. I looked at the kid, and I fell in love with her. If I have one obsession that is greater than alcohol, it might be my obsession to take care of my kids. Because as soon as I saw my oldest girl, all hell broke loose in my life, and I altered my life to become a businessman, the most successful businessman. The more successful I became, the harder I drank, because I could no longer fight. I have never hit anybody since the age of 20, because I dare not. But you allowed me to have the freedom that I'm wise enough now not to hit somebody, because I'm sure they'll kick the hell out of me. I'm too old for that crap today. But I was saying that, you know, it's just that I was so successful and I was so good and I was heir apparent. And these are the bad breaks that you have in life. And I come off of a running drunk. I was with five, I had five little girls by then, and I come off of a running drunk. And listening to a telephone where they are telling me that my wife had committed suicide. And I went mad. I went absolutely mad. And the next thing I know, I'm waking up and I'm in a hospital. I'm in the psychiatric wing of the Los Angeles General Hospital. And I'm laying on his gurney. And they got me in a straitjacket. And I got blood all over me. And they're just debating. And I can hear them debating. And the doctor is saying, I'm hearing them say, the doctor's saying, unstrap him. And they're saying, you don't dare. He'll hurt somebody bad. It took a dozen of us to put him in this damn straitjacket. He says, look, I got to sew him up because he's all chewed up and he's got a lot of cuts and he's going to bleed to death if we don't sew him up. And I looked up and I saw the doctor, and the doctor looked at me, and I can see the fear in his eyes. One of those dreadful things that I will remember. I remember that vividly. I remember the doctor looking at me and saying, you won't hurt me, will you? God, I never wanted to be like that, mad dog. You won't hurt me, will you? And I couldn't even answer him because I couldn't cry because that's all I wanted to do. My whole world had gone to hell that day. Everything I knew had gone to hell. I was remember a little reputations precede you even in a nut house. And I woke up in another ward. And they had me strapped down this time with a belt, leather belts. I don't know if you've ever been where I've been. That's what the leather belts are like. They had done a sloppy job, and I'm in there laying there with about four other guys. And I decide that I've got to get out to find out where my five little girls are. I'm going crazy again. I don't know where they are. I don't even know if they're alive. I don't know who's got them. I don't know where they're at. I'm going crazy. So I decide to unstrap myself. So I pick the leather belts off of myself so that I could stand up. These other guys in this room have already heard my reputation and they're terrified. And I stand up and I can just see the terror in their eyes. And I didn't want to hurt anybody. But they were afraid of me, and that was the story, and that's some of the stuff that I found when I got here. This is some of the action that I found about my drunk love, you know. And I got out of that nut house, and I went around to the. I went to. They fired me while I was in the nut house. I was, as I say, I was a quite successful young man. They fired me while I was in the nut house because I projected the wrong image. I guess I don't know. I've never read the newspaper account because my family has seen fit not to allow me to hear that, so I don't know what it was. And I went to one of the bosses, a man in another company. This is, you know, the bad breaks that I've always had. And as I went to the company that had been after me to come to work for them for years. This is in Southern California. And they've been after me to work for them for a long time. I walked in, I said, Bill, I need a job. He said, John, I know. I heard about it. He said, you've got a job. He says, it'll take a couple days for me to get the area squared away so you can have a territory, but you've got a job. Don't worry about it. Go home, take care of your little girls, and come back on Monday. I walked back on Monday, and he said, John, he said, I'm sorry. He says, I got 65 employees in this company, and I have on my desk a petition signed by 64 of them saying that they refuse to work with you. You're too goddamn rotten. And what's more, the gates of hell opened up a little bit and I had to leave. And I walked around in the greater Los Angeles area and no one would hire me because of my reputation for being such a badass. And I came to Northern California and learned how to become a mother and a father and a businessman. And there's enough ladies in this audience. I tell a story about the things I had to learn because being an adaptable alcoholic, as most of us are, we know how to survive. And since I had to do that, and this goes back a long days and long ways, and it goes back before wash and wear. I had five little girls with the prettiest dresses you would ever want to know.
They were glorious, and they all had to be ironed, and I had to teach myself how to iron. I taught myself how to cook. I had to keep house and iron. But one of my oldest girl had the most beautiful brown dress with white lace all the way around it. Just white yoke, big puff sleeves, and just lay upon it. It was a peasant style dress with laces all the way down. It was gorgeous white lace. And while I was sitting there with my Jack Daniels and the kids were asleep and I was ironing, because you have to learn how to do that left and right handed if you sit down and iron, I scorched the lace. And I didn't have an awful lot of money. And I made a wise decision that night, so I spent another 2.5 hours scorching all the rest of the lace to match. It was a beautiful brown dress when I was done. But that ungrateful kid never wore it. I told you that everything that is near and dear to me was given to me as the result of coming to you. Everything I have is new and has been new because I was taught. But today is the first day. And that is exciting news. And you have told me that I can do and become anything I want to be. I can go and do things that I have heretofore never dreamed was humanly possible. And that has come true to me. That has come true to pass. I remember when you offered me in the promises, you offered me a word called a new freedom. Newness I describe as something new, brand new, never before discovered, touched upon, or new, or used, brand new, mine, not even have any fingerprints on it. And I realized that when I analyze this, I realized I can be asked deep in the midst of my new freedom, and it's so new I would not even recognize it. This is a new freedom. It is a new happiness. I have a money clip. Today has money in it, and on the money clip is inscribed, my wife gave it to me in sobriety, and it says, all things are new. My life is new. Each day is new. I have a new wife. And believe me, I have a new wife. I was taught that if I pay all of my attention, interest, and love to the thing at hand, it becomes the most fascinating thing in the world. You told me I'd never have to hurt again as long as I live if I did certain things. And the hurting is the misery and the crap and the agony that I carried and brought in here. And the mistakes that I had made, which I was convinced that every mistake I have ever made in my entire life was forever. I did not know it was possible to make a one-day mistake until I got here. You promised me this, and you said I can go where free men go and do what free men do. And I did not know it was possible, but oh God, I wanted it. And I can stand before you and attest that I am free. And I can say that in terms and with such conviction that you may never hear another person say. And not because I'm so special, it's just that because I have had an experience in sobriety that is unequaled in my experience. And it has to do with freedom. But it also has to do with the same thing you tricked me into doing. Way back when. Way back when at the very beginning of this and part of this process, they said, you must learn how to pray. And I said, I'm not interested, thank you. Because I had not yet decided I was willing to go to any lengths. I was finding out what any lengths was. And then they said, well, you should be willing to learn how to pray. And I said, stick it in your ear, I'm not interested in that one either. And they kept willing to become willing. And finally you nailed me and I became willing to become willing to become willing to pray, to learn how to pray. And you tricked me because I immediately bought a book and I started to pray. I thought I was learning how to pray. But I do believe in prayer. I believe in prayer beyond the knowledge that I had ever think was possible. I was sitting there and when I got sober, and I'm about 5 months sober, and I suddenly realized, I can't work here any longer. Because he's a crook, the boss is, and so am I. And I cannot be a crook and work here. And so I had to quit a fine job making a lot of money. I had to quit that. And I had to go to the Father in prayer, and I said, Father, I need a job doing what I like to do. Makes enough money to live comfortably and allows me the freedom to work with other people. And as like my friend Jack and I were talking about it, he went broke and so did I. Doing and searching and trying to do. Hell, there wasn't enough drums in Northern California to satisfy me. I had to go down as commute to Los Angeles, back and forth. But in 9 months, I was stone-ass broke. And a young man or a man called me. A man that had known me for a long time, and he was calling me, John, we need help. And finally, I listened to him one night, and he said, we have a company we need to start. And I said, I need a job. He said, we can't pay you anything, but we need your help. Bam! This stupid program called Alcoholics Anonymous says that whenever anybody reaches out, I transcend alcohol, I must be, my job, my life must be dedicated to love and service. So I went to help the slum. Start his stupid company. I own it today. Love and service, the most amazing thing. But that's part of prayer. When my daughter tells me that I got sober as the result of those fools in a Bible study class offering to help a poor soul like me. And that as a result of that, I get sober. And as a prayer, and I go to my father once and I said to him, I said, Dad, hey, this is crazy. Some outrageous miracle had occurred in my life. And I go to him and I say to him, Father, I don't understand what's happening here. You've got miracles going left and right. And I'm just dumbfounded. I didn't know this crap was happening. And if you've got any more of them suckers coming down, let me know. I want to hear about it. I want to see it. And I've been seeing miracles ever since. I go to my father and I said, I don't understand this thing. I am just absolutely amazed. I have been given so much. Oh, God, I have been given so much. Why is it that you continue to give and give and give to someone like me and give and give? Why? And I hear a voice just as clear today as the day I heard it. And it said, give it back. And so I believe in prayer and I've been trying to give it back ever since. And the prayer and story that I'll tell you about to get back to freedom is this. Is that it came time for me to stop smoking. And the reason I say that is because I decided it was time for me to stop smoking, but I wasn't willing to stop smoking. I'm just a dyed-in-the-wool, stubborn SOB son of a gun called alcoholics. They are the most special people on the face of this earth. And I said, it's time for me to stop smoking, but I'm not willing. And you said, ask for willingness. And I said, no way, you tricked me once, I'm not going to do that again. They worked the steps on it, and I said, I can't work the steps because I'm not willing to go to any lengths to get free of smoking. And they said, well, ask for willingness. And I said, no, because God will give it to me, and I'm not willing, and I'll throw it away. Because I don't believe in frivolous prayer. So, I came up with a perfect prayer. I submitted to him. Perfect prayer. I was totally satisfied with it. I said, Father, make it difficult for me to continue to smoke. I have no regrets behind that prayer. That was on a Sunday night. Monday. It was on a Monday night. Tuesday. I get a phone call, and this is a disease of alcoholism, and just sends me right up a tree. I believe in prayer, and I do an awful lot of praying outside of my office, out on the damn boulevard, in front of a tree, and I scream to God, and I bitch, and I moan, and I vent my anger, and I vent all of the things that I find that he's doing wrong, and I tell him about it. And a young man in the fellowship called me, and he said, John, he said, I just woke up in a saloon. I said, Christ, you were fine Saturday. He said, I know, I went into a blackout. He hadn't had a drink for a month. He went into a blackout. And he woke up in a bar and he had his mouth full of whiskey. And he spit it out. And he called me. And I said, I'll come get you. He said, no, no. He says, I feel fine. There's nothing wrong with me. He said, what'll I do? And I said, if you want to know if you're sober or not, go down and get tested. Go down to the Park Alameda at that time. So he went down there. And I'm furious about the disease of alcoholism. Here's a young man who's trying so hard to get sober, and I reached out and snatched his ass, but I find it objectionable. I go out under the tree, and I'm screaming to Dad. I'm saying, not fair, should not happen, illegal, halt, no. And I'm all finished with it. I start walking back into my office, and I said, God, I have a bad case of indigestion. By the time I made it into my front office, I said, Jesus, this is serious. I think I'd better call the doctor. And when I got to the next office, I said, oh, God, somebody better call the doctor. And I took a couple more steps and I fell over. And they rushed me to the San Jose hospital. I had a heart attack. I haven't smoked since then. But that's not the story. You see, this is not a story of being beware of what you're praying for. That's not what it... No, I don't believe that crap. If you pray for it, you're going to get it, one way or the other. But you just pay attention to what the hell you're doing, and that's why I wired the prayer the way I did it. My story is about freedom and how it is that I can stand here as confidently. You see, I was told that when I finished my first 9 steps, that I would owe no one anything and that I would be free at last. And I believed you. And so I have done that. And while I'm on the table at the San Jose Hospital, and I'm in his, and they have taken care of this agonizing pain, this unbelievable pain, that you have to feel to find out what it is like. And I'm just kind of laying there, and I'm hearing them talk about me. And then I hear that I have died. Now, if you're hearing people talking about you, and they said you died, it makes you think. And then these are what my feelings and these are my thoughts that I would share with you. My first feeling was a rush of impending good. A real strong rush. You know the feeling that you feel when you're convinced you're going to win lotto? You know, I had it. God, I said, wow, now I'm really going to know. God, I'm going to know. You see, because if you believe in God, dying is but a geographic. It's a pretty good-sized geographic, but it still nevertheless is a geographic. And then I looked back at my life and I said to myself, wow, isn't this grand? My lady knows I love her because I've demonstrated it and I've told her. My children know I love them because I've demonstrated it and I have told them. And all the people in my life that are near and dear to me love me and know it, and I love them and they know it because I've told them. And I owe no one anything. I am free. There's a saying that I was taught at the very beginning. It says, you're not free to go until you're free to stay. And the reverse is, you're not free to stay until you're free to go. And I am free because you said I could be free. Absolutely free. You have given me an opportunity to come from where I came from, the depths of despair and agony with a mountain of problems. And you have allowed me to come to you, and something magic has happened to me and has happened to you. Because I can stand before you and say this, and so can you, if you think about it. The world's a better place because I'm in it. Why? Because I'm putting in good stuff instead of taking out shit, which is what I've been doing all my life. Isn't that magnificent? To come to the place, the last place you'd ever want to come to in the first place. This is where the good life is mine. This is where the good life is yours. Where life has meaning at last. There is a line in the front of the book, or right in one of the page 55, that says, with this attitude you cannot fail.
the consciousness of your belief is sure to come to you. It has come to me. I hope it has come to you. And I want to thank you very much for allowing me to be here this evening.